It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Rifle Association has become a central pillar of conservative politics in recent years, according to scholar Alexandra Philindra. We examine the NRA's history and its influence on life in Wisconsin, and you can be part of the discussion, calling in with a question, adding your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Alexandra Philindra is an associate professor of political science at University of Illinois Chicago. Her book is called Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture. Alexandra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you for having me.
So the NRA is the focus of books. It makes news headlines. What do you think is often misunderstood about the organization that you hope to clear up?
A lot of people tend to think of the NRA in its current form and think of it as a lobbying organization that is basically has always been in cahoots with the gun producers, the manufacturers, and that it always has been an organization that has been anti-government and that it has been supporting of these expansive rights to firearms for individuals. And the reality is that the NRA has a very interesting, very, very long history that goes back to the 1870s.
And we're gonna get into that history, throughout the conversation. So looking back to 2021, the NRA's leader said in a legal deposition that its membership was just under 4.9 million. And that estimate suggested declining membership from previous years. Is the NRA's political influence declining?
I don't think so. The NRA itself, maybe in decline because it's in a really deep legal problems. New York State wants to yank its a charter to operate, which again goes back to 1871. But the influence of the culture that the NRA has created is unlikely to go away because it has become a central pillar to Republican politics, and because it has also become the law of the land. It has become part of the justification of recent Supreme Court decisions in Heller and McDonald and Bruin.
What does NRA membership symbolize in our society now? What does it mean?
So one part of the NRA culture and messaging is about individual self-defense, and that it's sort of to protect ourselves from crime. But there is another very deep and very deeply held set of principles within the NRA and the gun culture that we talk about it less. And this is the political dimension of the NRA culture and how it understands the people's relationship with government. And this is a very, very old idea. Basically, the way that the gun culture understands guns is as a form of expressing good citizenship. It is virtuous for people to own firearms and to be in the ready. And the reason that this is virtuous and a good thing is because it signals preparedness to protect the country from domestic and foreign attackers, from enemies. The people are armed to protect the country from any evil that may befall us. And this goes along with beliefs that are also very long-standing, that unless you're prepared to die for the country, unless you're virtuous, you are actually, people are very frail. They're, in terms of their personalities and in terms of who we are as a human nature, we are very easily drawn to luxury. We are really easily drawn to corruption because we like good things. We like easy things. So unless we insist in maintaining principles, we are very likely to tip the scales more in terms of our self-interest and what's good for us, which is not necessarily the same thing as the public good. And gun preparedness and association with the gun culture is supposed to make you more likely to think of the public good, be a good citizen.
We're talking, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in here and reintroduce you as we look at the origins of the National Rifle Association with Alexandra Flindra, author of Race, Rights, and Rifles. You can join the conversation along the way. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Alexandra, what's so interesting about your book is that you take us back to the origin story and the birth of the NRA in the 19th century as a training regiment for National Guardsmen. What was the organization's original goal?
So the NRA came out of the Civil War. It was an organization that was made up of National Guardsmen who had served in the Civil War and were horrified by the quality of training that exhibited by National Guardsmen, by the militia. That's what they were called then, the state, the military of the state during the Civil War. There are reports by independent observers, like Swiss observers had come in to attend the Civil War and observe the course of the war. And they were talking about militia who were always drunk. They fell over their guns drunk. They fell asleep. They couldn't work with each other because there were no basically discipline regimes that linked militia together. There were no organizational programs, nothing that would help militia from one state to work with militia from another state or even from the next town over, because these were completely independent organizations. So these officers thought that it would be a great opportunity for a public-private partnership where the NRA would be formed and work with the state to train the citizen soldiers, the National Guard, and also the men who were of draft age, because this is the period where we are starting American militarization. This is the time of American empire. This is the time on and on. We're getting closer to World War One. Militarization is actually, militarism is a value that's held pretty strongly across both parties.
So, I just want to jump in here. So, as the NRA sees this, I guess inability of the National Guard to be to have the training and the precision, is that how you see like marksmanship and the development of shooting skills and gun ranges become part of the NRA's mission?
Yes, essentially they think, let's create a system of ranges, a system of training facilities across the country that would be privately owned and operated, but the state or the federal government would provide funding for these activities and incentives for regular Joes, for the men of the nation who are not in the military, to participate in these activities. So it's a private-public partnership for the purpose of training people in the art of war, specifically marksmanship. They didn't particularly care about other forms of training that the military wanted to do.
Let's pause here with political scientist Alexandra Flindra, author of a new book on the National Rifle Association and gun culture in America. And there's room for your take. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, your analysis, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. There are more guns than people who live in America. That estimate by the Small Arms Survey. We examine the National Rifle Association and its ties to gun ownership and political activism on gun rights in Wisconsin and the nation. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Alexandra Philindra, an associate professor of political science at University of Illinois Chicago. Her book is called Race, Rights, and Rifles. Alexandra, we heard from Matt, who wrote in to say, when you look at the definition of a terrorist group, how exactly isn't the NRA one? It promotes violence to reach a political goal. Do you see the NRA as a terrorist group?
Not quite. I don't see the NRA as a terrorist group because I see the way the NRA sees itself is as the expression of democratic spirit. And it goes with a very old expression of democracy, which goes back to ancient Greece. And it has to do with a good citizen being prepared to protect the country at arms against corruption by political leaders. That is sort of the way that the NRA sees itself, as an expression of democracy. And it's very difficult to attribute terrorist motives to an organization like that, because terrorism, then basically a very large proportion of our country's citizens would be called terrorists, because there's a very large number of people who share this ideology.
You used the word virtuous earlier, and I'm wondering if you can explain like the NRA's vision for that ideal of being a virtuous citizen soldier and who fits that.
Sure. Basically, the idea of a virtuous citizen soldier goes back to ancient Greeks and to the Roman Republic. It is the ideal that in a democratic society, the people, the members of the society, the citizens, in order to be good citizens, they have to be committed to the country. And the way that they're committed to the country is by being ready to give up their lives, to give up their livelihoods for the public good. They're not pursuing just the private good in politics. They're not doing things for to line their own pockets. They are there to actually promote the public good, which sounds like a very noble idea. And it's inspired the American Revolution in many ways. It was central to the American Revolution. The problem today with ideas like that are based on militarism and that are based on the idea that the good citizen is the one who owns arms and is ready to fight for tyranny, is twofold. It's who exactly is that person who should and can be ready to carry guns in the bare arms in the name of the republic, and then who decides what is tyranny? And that's where the problem lies today with the NRA and with some of its supporters, that the way that basically we have come to the point where small groups of individuals are now saying we get to decide what's tyranny. And we saw that on January 6th. And that's not the way this was envisioned, that small groups of people based on their own criteria decide what's tyranny and just storm the Capitol.
So when you look at the ideology that you call the true American citizen ideology, focusing on Christianity, whiteness, patriarchy, and militarism, how do you see this ideology at work in the National Rifle Association?
It's part of its core narratives. If you look at its magazine, The American Rifleman, for example, you see who the audience is. The NRA has tried very hard to recruit women and people of color in recent years and presents itself or tries to present itself as an egalitarian, I see no color type of ideology and organization. But in reality, when you look at the pages of the magazine, there are no men of color. There are no women of color. They're only white men. In for years and years and years, over 150 years, almost of NRA magazines that actually have pictures in them, it's just white men that show up. It's white men, for a lot of the time, it's military white men and then civilian white men as well. Women are very, very infrequently mentioned. And when they are, they're mentioned not as political agents. They're not citizen soldiers. There is only one cover of the magazine that actually has featured a female member of the military. She was a nurse in 1964 that was an expert shooter, and they have her on the cover. They don't have any women soldiers on their pages. They don't have any women police officers. They don't have any women at arms. Women are presented as victims of crime, especially of rape, and as in need of help. And this is a very patriarchal, very sexist understanding of womanhood as the mother or the wife who needs protection from the man in her life or the man on the street.
Alexandra Philindra, author of Race, Rights, and Rifles, as we look at the origins of the National Rifle Association and the NRA of today, with your thoughts and questions as we go at any point, 800-642-1234. Alexandra, as you talk about the NRA magazine, the American Rifleman, you looked throughout this magazine, through decades. Why did you have to rely on the magazine to understand the NRA?
Well, it is the vehicle through which it reached its audience. It talks about its beliefs. It tells you the story of who the NRA is. It tells you what it does. And it tells you very clearly how it sees the world, both in terms of who are the good guys with guns and who are the bad guys with guns, and what's the role of government in this narrative that it's building. And it's very consistent in many ways over time in how it describes things and who it thinks is good and bad.
Is the white male authoritative rifleman in the framing that you view the NRA through history, is that white male control reflective of the organization today?
I believe so. The membership, the leadership of the organization is by and large white. And I know this from elections. I tried to actually check who was running for elections. For a long time, they were putting the candidates on the magazine, and they had little blurbs on the candidates for their board. So I could figure out who they were and what they did. I tried to map it for as long as that was part of the magazine. But it continues to be that organization of mostly white men who think of themselves as protectors of an understanding of who a good American is and what the American system should be like. And that they're good citizens protecting people and protecting the country from a bad turn in government, from a political corruption that is expressed through cultural change.
And so you really see like the NRA's, quote, good guy with a gun versus the bad guy with the gun. And that bad guy, as you mentioned, could be a person of color.
That bad guy Definitely could be a person of color. It's also a political opponent of the NRA who promotes ideologies of multiculturalism. So whether it is themselves a person of color, usually the way that people of color are portrayed on the pages of the American Rifleman is implicitly in terms of crime. There's a lot of talk about crime, and there are stories about virtuous gun owners who basically defeated a robber or a murderer.
Let's pause right there. Alexandra Flinda studies the influence of the NRA through time. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how the National Rifle Association operates today and its effects on gun policies and politics in Wisconsin and the nation. You can be part of this discussion on the NRA's evolution. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alexandra Falindra is a political scientist at University of Illinois, Chicago, and the new book is called Race, Rights, and Rifles. Let's go to Scott now in Franklin. Scott, hi. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd like to revisit a question that somebody brought up earlier about NRA being more like a terrorist organization. I'd like to highlight the guest cited the original purpose was democratic, virtuous, protection, but times have changed. It's acknowledged that it's heavily aligned with politics, caters to power, money has redefined itself. As an organization, is it possible that if someone's usurped the narrative that they were supposed to have been subtly, and it no longer aligns with, or they can just ignore non-virtuous ideologies that are developed? My concern is, in the long run, isn't that much more dangerous, creating an entire cohort that's gaslit? Like, are they just waiting for a new politician to pick up the torch, and they can just justify what they've done with this realigned narrative? I'll take my answer offline.
Scott, thank you so much. Alexandra, go ahead.
Sure. Scott, you are right in the fact that this is a very dangerous repurposing of an ideology. We are at a very, very perilous time because we have created a cultural and institutional moment where we have essentially given people the right to own and carry firearms in the public space for the purpose of combating tyranny. And this is not the NRA. This is the Supreme Court in Heller talking. So when we have actually determined, and by we, I mean our institutions, the Supreme Court, that American citizens have the right to basically use firearms in order to prevent tyranny, and it's thus in their right to determine what tyranny is, or that we don't trust our institutions and our elections to protect us against government abuse, we actually need to put a gun in the face of elected officials to prevent them from behaving badly. We are veering very far away from the real ideals of democracy. And this is a contribution of the NRA to the current political culture. But it has been picked up by other political agents, such as the Republican Party and the Supreme Court, the conservative Supreme Court. The presence of the NRA today in this culture has diminished because it has really achieved its aim. This understanding of democracy is now part of our official understanding of the relationship between the citizen and their government. So it is a big, big problem that we have created.
a federal judge this month sentences former Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio to 22 years in prison for his role in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Are groups like the Proud Boys considered part of contemporary gun culture?
Yes, they definitely are. And they totally ascribe to this idea that it is through basically that it's their civic duty to be prepared to fight against the corrupt government. Actually, it was him or the head of the not the Proud Boys, of the Oath Keepers. Who actually claimed in court that his organization is a patriotic organization with a civic organization, and he should get credit for that. So he buys into that mentality that what he's doing is being a good citizen, ready to protect his version of what institutions should be like and what society should be like and what our values should be like through guns. And that's a good thing.
Are prison sentences for leaders of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, is that affecting gun culture?
I think that it's affecting those very violent networks. For a lot of people who participate in this, this is sort of being weekend warriors, and it stays within sort of the narrative and the rhetoric. The vast majority of people we know are not going to transition to radical action and to violence, which is a very good thing for American democracy. But there are small networks of people who have become radicalized and who can be violent and who are violent. What these court cases have done is to disrupt these networks. And that makes it more difficult for them to organize. And that is also good news for the upcoming election cycle. But there are enough people out there who can reorganize. And that mentality, this ideology, feeds into that and allows people, especially through social media, to come together and create groups that fight for this vision of the world, this very armed sort of democracy comes from the barrel of a gun vision of the world.
We're talking about the origins of the National Rifle Association and modern gun culture today in Wisconsin and the nation. Alexandra Flindra, author of Race, Rights, and Rifles. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us from Stoughton. Steve, hi.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for the discussion. I wish we could have more discussion like this. Listen, I do not like guns. I hate that the gun culture has taken over seemingly the rights, every other right. The gun culture usurps every other right, it seems. But what I've, and that's all another discussion, so, and I appreciate Scott bringing that up and the guest responding to that. But what I was wondering is if the guest could talk about the NRA's role in it, since the book is about race and guns and the NRA. In the 60s, when the Black Panthers took up arms against the government in California, the NRA was behind the government, is my understanding, to fight against the Black Panthers owning guns and protecting their rights. Could the guest talk a little bit about that from a historical culture perspective?
Steve, thank you. Alexandra.
Yes, Steve, you are right. Indeed, the NRA was not a very big fan of the Black Panthers. There is an editorial from 1971, which is called Of Black Panthers and Blind Kittens. And they basically claim that the Black Panthers are a racist organization because their goals are to promote equality for Black people, whereas the NRA is not a racist organization, could never be called a racist organization because their goal is to protect democracy and to promote the rights of all sportsmen, regardless of race. And it's interesting that they say sportsmen because women are not part of this world. Yes, they were not very fond of what happened in Sacramento in 1967. And they didn't explicitly back Ronald Reagan, but they did not really go very far against the law in California. Mm-hmm. But the relationship between the NRA and race is quite complicated because in recent years, especially since the 90s and the early 2000s, they have been using race and especially the African-American experience with slavery and Jim Crow, but also the Holocaust as warning signs. They have been saying that this is why we need guns. This is why individuals need to own guns and be ready to fight a corrupt and evil government. Because at the extremes, what a government could do is enslave you, literally, not politically, literally. It can kill you the way it did in the Holocaust. If only African-American people had guns, maybe they would have saved themselves from slavery. If only Jewish people had guns in Germany, maybe they would have prevented the Holocaust from happening. So it's sort of like a warning tale.
Hmm.
And it resonates with some people within those communities, but as a broader message that there is a link between gun ownership and the rights of the political rights of minorities or of excluded people, it just doesn't fly because... Yes, go ahead.
You also point out that the NRA has branded itself as the oldest and largest civil rights organization in the world, using civil rights, that terminology, in a different way than we use it in the broader context of society.
That is correct, yes. And it points to its emergence at the time of Reconstruction.
Mm.
And it creates this sleight of hand narrative where they say in 1871, the Ku Klux Klan reigned the nation. And across from it arose a new organization, the NRA. And people have made, in this sort of formulation, the relationship is not clear. They're not saying that one caused the other. But for a lot of people, that's how they present it. And actually, one of the presidential candidates from the Republican Party, Mr. I'm going to bungle his name, Ramaswamy,
mm-hmm.
Sort of presented this kind of formulation in his interview with CNN on CNN with on a show there a few weeks ago, like a couple of months ago. And the reality is that there is absolutely zero connection between the two. And if anything, the NRA of that era was part of the military establishment of the United States, which was a segregated military establishment for white men. No one in the NRA of that time would think of themselves as civil rights warriors who protected the rights of African Americans or anyone else, a minority community, for that matter.
Alexandra Philindra studies American gun culture and the role of the National Rifle Association over 150 years. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with political scientist Alexandra Philindra, who studies the evolution of gun ownership in America, the influence of the National Rifle Association on life in Wisconsin and the nation. Her book on the NRA is titled Race, Rights, and Rifles. You can call in and ask a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Nate is here from Milwaukee. Nate, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was going to ask if there were a few myths that might have been promoted or bad ideas in both in general but also in specific. I know somebody who joined the NRA was told that gun safeties would slow down his ability to use the gun, so he shouldn't have one. And so he got himself a pistol that went off very easily, and he accidentally shot himself in the leg. Thankfully, he recovered. But I think that that's a sort of bad idea. Also, the myth that or the idea that guns prevent crime or red state politics prevent crime. If you look at the murder rate in Texas and compare it to New York, New York is actually a lot safer. Same thing if you compare like Minnesota to Alabama.
Nate, thank you for the call. Alexandra, how does the NRA view firearms training and safe handling practices for gun ownership in the anecdote Nate relayed?
So the NRA is basically, for all intents and purposes, the monopoly provider of guns training in the nation, because it trains the trainers, or it has been training the trainers. The vast majority of trainers are NRA trained. To its credit, the NRA is very serious about gun safety when it comes to training on how to properly use firearms. They do spend a lot of time talking about that. At the same time, because of their absolutist position on gun control and the slippery slope, they have taken positions on policy that are adverse to promoting good training and good practices. For example, they have been against lockboxes because based on anecdotal evidence that what about the case where the person didn't have enough time to get the firearm out of the box. So they're creating the situation where on the one hand, on the range, they teach you proper safety protocols, but then when they talk about it and what they write in their magazine sometimes, it goes against the idea of having a very serious, proper training protection for your firearms.
Because those could come down from federal or state law regulations that go against their ideals. Is that part of it?
It is in part. So sometimes they are responding to state and federal regulations, but state and federal regulations have become a lot looser. Mm-hmm. Today, what counts as training is mostly online. Like in some places, it's like you take an online class and you spend a couple of hours on the range, and you're trained. There you go. You can take a gun and put it in your house with your children. It didn't used to be that. And in many other places in the world, it's definitely not like that. But because of the fear that states could use training and protective regulations, like requirements to store your gun properly, to keep ammunition away from your gun, things like that, they're resisting even that. So they have created this situation where even though they are very strongly for good training and good protection, at the same time, the policies that they fight basically go against their own principles.
Let's go to Mike and Spooner. Mike, what is your story?
Actually, I want to change a little bit. first of all, I dropped the NRA because they don't really represent us anymore, us gun owners, as well as they used to. They kind of keep caving in constantly. So they give up too much, so I dropped them.
You mean you were a member and now you're not a member? Is that what I'm hearing?
I was. Okay. I was. I actually dumped them and joined the National Concealed Carry Association instead.
And, Mike, what was the reason and what question do you have?
Well, the reason I dropped them was because they're always caving in. They're caving in constantly to the pressure. I mean, they're going for something. I mean, they'll give up something, but they don't go for something else. After the Vegas shooting and the bump stocks, the rumor was they're gonna quit support the bump stocks and go for national reciprocity on the concealed carry, which would make things so much easier for everybody. And they didn't do it. They just caved in.
And Mike, we're short on time. Alexandra, what is your reaction there on the organization softening its views?
No, I don't think that the organization is has softened its views. Even on bomb stocks, it has waffled a little bit, but not by much. And its position has always been that the only way to protect from bad guys with guns is with good guys with guns. And good guys with guns should have as much freedom to own guns anywhere and everywhere in order to protect the Republic and individuals and their families from crime and from bad government. There are more extremist organizations that take even more hardline positions on a lot of things in the gun culture. But certainly, I would not think of the NRA as an organization that has become softer with age.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your book.
Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Flyndra is the author of Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.